Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I want to tell you about a podcast Preconceived listeners will really be into. Uncertain Things, a show where uncertainty is embraced, partisanship rejected, and ideas challenged. Uncertain Things hosts are two jaded journalists who've interviewed and argued with some stellar guests. They've grilled writer Matt Taibbi on the mediocrity of media, pressed historian Neil Ferguson about the end of the world, and asked The Atlantic's Caitlin Flanagan why sex has gotten so bad, statistically speaking. If you want to leave your preconceptions behind, and if you're listening to this pod, I think you do, then check out Uncertain Things wherever you get your podcast. That's Uncertain Things.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey, everybody, I'm Zayo Mednick, and welcome to a special episode of Preconceived. We've been telling you over the last several episodes about this exciting new book that we're launching called Preconceived, Challenging the Preconceptions in Our Lives. And it is now live as it is launching today. You can get a copy of this book on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, or Amazon anywhere. We've put a lot of time and effort into this book, obviously, and super excited for listeners and non-listeners to buy and read the book. In this episode, I want to give you a little glimpse into the book. So I'm going to read the introduction of the book, which explains the premise of what it's about. And then it's going to be followed by four entries into the book by various authors. And you'll understand more what I'm talking about when I read the introduction, which explains the nature of the book. It's available today, so please don't hesitate in ordering your copy. Thank you, as always, for your continued support of the podcast and of this book, and just of Preconceived in general. Without your listenership, this would not be possible. And we're very, very grateful for your support over the past few years in launching this whole initiative. Without further ado, here is the introduction of Preconceived. Introduction by Zayo Mednick. In many ways, each of our lives is a blank canvas, an empty template that we get to decide how to fill. If afforded the liberties of living in a democratic country, we have the freedom to choose our own path in this world. We get to decide how we want to experience life and how we navigate the sometimes overwhelming plethora of choice in our modern age. But despite this apparent freedom to choose our own paths, do you ever feel like you're simply going through the motions? I know that I do. For all the self-empowering talk of charting our own courses in life and forming our own unique opinions, I've often wondered if that is how I truly live myself. There are so many embedded societal expectations that most of us tend to follow, perhaps not even realizing it. Think of the general path in life to which many of us subscribe. a typical classroom education in our younger years, a subsequent college or work experience, a string of monogamous relationships until we find the one and get married, a stable career often entailing 9-to-5 work hours, becoming a parent and raising our kids, and eventually retiring in our older years and spending time with our grandkids. While there is nothing wrong with such a path, perhaps the critical point is that each of these steps should be a conscious choice, not a foregone conclusion. Are you having kids because you truly want to become a parent? Or have you simply reached the age when having kids is the natural next step? Are you in a monogamous relationship because it reflects your authentic views on love and romance? Or have you just never considered the alternatives? Have you stayed in the same career for the past 15 years because it still fits with your true goals and desires? Or is the notion of a complete pivot this far into your life too far from the norm of a typical life trajectory? Beyond the aforementioned paradigm that dictates how we should live our lives, we are often indoctrinated to certain viewpoints that shape the way we view the world. From a young age, we're exposed both to practices we take for granted as normal and social and political opinions that become so ingrained in us that they're tough to ever shake. It can almost feel impossible to form pure and uninfluenced opinions later in our lives when certain perspectives and belief systems have so strongly taken hold in our psyches for so long. Is being a sex worker actually immoral? Or have we just grown up being told that anything sex-related is taboo? Is circumcision just an innocent cultural ritual? Or is it a potentially harmful form of genital mutilation? Is veganism really so extreme? Or is it the routine practice of processing and eating animals that is actually the extreme? In 2019, I started the Preconceived podcast while at a juncture in my own life. I was finishing my training as an ophthalmologist, a career I do enjoy and continue to practice full-time today. But as I entered practice and embarked on this next stage of my life, I couldn't help but wonder, am I living the life that is authentic to me, or am I following the preordained path that society has encouraged me to follow? Now that my school was officially coming to an end and I experienced a new sense of freedom, it was one of the first times I actively wondered whether I'd been filling the canvas of my life with the colors, patterns, and designs I truly wanted. What followed and continues to this day is one of the most fulfilling journeys of my life. Over the past 3 years, I've interviewed over 160 people who've had the bravery to share their own unfiltered truths on the podcast. The goal of Preconceived is to challenge the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Each episode of the podcast explores a different topic about which people tend to have preconceptions. Episodes have covered themes related to relationships, politics, medicine, philosophy, history, and many other aspects of society and culture. The podcast has been recognized by the Quill Podcast Awards as Best Society and Culture Podcast of 2021 and the Most Innovative Podcast of 2022. What follows here is a collection of stories, thoughts, and beliefs of over 50 of the guests who've joined me on the show. Each author was asked the following questions. In regards to your own area of expertise, what's the greatest preconception that people tend to have? We make presumptions and form opinions on pretty much everything we encounter. And like the podcast, the following vignettes seek to open our eyes both to new viewpoints on topics we may already have strong opinions on and those we barely considered at all. The goal of this book is not to convince you of anything. In fact, the opinions expressed in this book are oftentimes at odds with each other, reflecting the author's varying perspectives. The intention of this collection is simply to open your eyes and challenge your own beliefs about the world and the life you are living. If there is one thing I've learned over the past few years, it is that changing the ways we think can be easier said than done. An idea might resonate with me, or a conversation might change my opinion. But because certain views and stories are so entrenched, it's often tough to truly internalize those new outlooks and make any active changes in my life. But I've also come to realize that that too is okay. Perhaps the mere act of acknowledging our preconceptions is the first step to becoming better versions of ourselves, more open and adaptable versions of ourselves. The profits from this book will be going towards the charitable organization Pencils for Kids, P4K. P4K is a volunteer-run Canadian charity. Since 2005, it has changed the lives of thousands of women and children in Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world, with new schools, kindergartens, teacher training, scholarship for girls, the Cooper Sewing Center, and an income-generating farming program for women, farmers of the future. It is also opening the first training school for horticultural technicians in the country, called the Dove Center. In 2021, 46 children aged 3 to 5 died when fires destroyed their kindergartens that were made of straw. As a result, children of this age are no longer allowed to attend any kindergarten in Niger that is made of straw. To address this strategy and encourage education, P4K has launched Project Kindergarten to rebuild many kindergartens out of cement and give the opportunity to thousands of children to continue with their education. 100% of the profit of this book will go towards Project Kindergarten in its pursuit to rebuild kindergartens.
Chapter Dinosaurs by Callie Moore.
As humans, it can be tough to comprehend the billions of years that preceded our existence. All we have ever known is a world completely, and in many respects, overly dominated by our own species, Homo sapiens. Aside from the Earth's humanless past, it can be equally challenging for humans to consider a future devoid of Homo sapiens as the dominant species. As a paleontologist, I am immersed daily in the records and fossils of the past, particularly those of dinosaurs. It never ceases to amaze me how a creature of such size and magnitude that once dominated the world for so many years could essentially just disappear. Let me try and shed some light on the scope of just how dominant dinosaurs once were in this world. In terms of size, some of them were the largest land animals that ever existed, over 100 feet long and up to 70 tons. You could think of some of them as walking blue whales. There's simply nothing like them today. In terms of their time on Earth, dinosaurs were around for approximately 175 million years. Contrast that to the mere 300,000 years that Homo sapiens have been around, and their longevity is almost impossible to grasp. Dinosaurs first show up in the fossil record in the late Triassic period, about 240 million years ago. At this point in time, dinosaurs only comprised about 6 to 10% of animals in any ecosystem. It wasn't until the Jurassic period when dinosaurs really took off. Just 10 million years into the Jurassic period, they were far and away the most dominant land animal on Earth, having spread everywhere across the globe. Dinosaurs existed for such a long span that many of the most well-known dinosaurs didn't even overlap together in their time on Earth. Stegosaurus, for example, lived in the late Jurassic period, about 155 million years ago, whereas T-Rex existed about 67 million years ago. Thus, T-Rex actually lived closer in time to humans than it did to Stegosaurus. The point is, dinosaurs ruled this world for a very, very, very long time, with a dominance that is tough for the human mind to fully comprehend. Yet despite such dominance, the reign of the dinosaurs did come to an end when a giant 7 to 10 mile wide asteroid slammed into the Earth over 66 million years ago. The sheer impact of the asteroid, the subsequent release of radioactive dust into the air, and the concurrent volcanic eruptions formed a lethal combination that was able to wipe out the dinosaurs in a very short period of time, probably within one generation. Perhaps my biggest takeaway from the dinosaurs is that even if you're the dominant form of life for 175 million years, your day will end one way or another. For the dinosaurs, it ended with a giant space rock. For humans, perhaps it will end with climate change or some other supernatural event. But just like the day of the dinosaurs came to an end, so will the day of Homo sapiens. That's probably the best knowledge that the dinosaurs have imparted to us. As a paleontologist, I feel like the history, and particularly the extinction of the dinosaurs, has given me a much deeper respect for everything that is alive today. Knowing that our time is limited and knowing that species are only on this planet for a very short period of time makes everything in life feel more weighted. Whole lineages can disappear in the blink of an eye, and they can't come back. Extinction is final. Humans are currently towing the line of extinction, and while the dinosaurs showed us that all lineages do die out at some point, knowing that we may be the cause of our own demise is a tough pill to swallow. I think if more people understood how finite extinctions were, they might respect nature and our Earth a little bit more.
Depression by Joshua Rivadal. As a mental health educator and someone who lives with two mental illnesses, clinical depression and generalized anxiety disorder, I wish more people had a clearer understanding of what mental illness is and isn't. Most of the time, my mental illnesses don't really affect me on a major level. They're a little like background noise in my daily life. I can treat them as such, still paying them some attention, because I've worked hard over the past 10 years to live and grow with them. To give you a clearer idea of what depression can look like, I want to introduce you to mine, sharing how I began to really work with my depression during a painful period in 2018. Hey, dummy. You can't keep trying to run away from me. I'm always going to be with you. She's divorcing you. She doesn't love you. You don't love you. You're nothing. You're worse than nothing. You're my bitch. Easy. I think she still loves me. And so do other people. I'm just tired. And sad. And I am not your bitch. Yeah? Why are you here again? Sad. Miserable. Lonely. Take a drink. Take 20. You'll feel better. No. Shut the hell up. Why are you so pissed off anyway? Ha ha. It's none of your damn business. I'm calling a friend. I don't need this right now. That's my depression talking. I've been living with this character my entire life, though we only met formally after I turned 27. His name is Dwayne. He can be cool sometimes, but other times he can be an arrogant D-bag. And all this extra negativity coming from him, as of the past 6 months or so, it's kind of my fault. The pain of this divorce is taking a toll. I also haven't been taking Dwayne on regular walks or working out with him like I should. We do like the same music, but lately, I haven't been listening to the kind he likes. And he's mad that I haven't been feeding him healthy food either. Right now, I'm holding a bottle of vodka in one hand and a glass of ice in the other, but I haven't poured it yet. Sometimes I try to use vodka to shut Dwayne up. It never works for long. Lately, it's just made him louder and angrier. So I've cut back the booze pretty drastically. Except I found a half-empty bottle at the bottom of my pantry the other day. And now Dwayne is practically screaming at me that we finish it together. So tempting. Just pour the damn drink and be done with it already. When you drink, your problems go away. And they come right back in the morning. We've been through this a million times. Yeah, Poppy. But this time it'll be different. I promise. See? Good boy. Pour it. Put it to your lips. Good boy. No, I say, slamming my drink on the kitchen counter and then pouring it down the drain. I won't this time. I'm going outside. That's my boy. A cigarette. Finally, something we can both enjoy. Dwayne is right. We both find temporary pleasure in nicotine. I've quit that too, but found an old pack today in the nightstand on the side where she used to sleep. I haven't been taking care of him or myself lately. So I take one of her old cigarettes out onto the balcony. I inhale the first drag of tar, nicotine, and pure momentary bliss. Dwayne is loving life right now, too. But my lungs and heart, however, are both incredibly angry with me. They're threatening to go on strike if I don't quit smoking for good. Unlike Dwayne, both my lungs and heart have asked that their names be withheld for privacy purposes. Why are we back inside? I'm already bored. I can just keep making fun of you. Or you can start hitting yourself. Remember when you used to do that? It's not going to help get us what we want or what we need. It's tough to admit this, but from ages 6 to 13, Dwayne used to tell me it was okay to slap myself in the head repeatedly when things got too intense at home or when I couldn't solve a homework problem. Eventually, I figured out how to tell Dwayne that physically hurting myself wasn't good, and I stopped. But lately, he's been tempting me to start again. I see you looking at that bottle of medication. That would be easy. Do it like your dad did. No, we're not going back to that place. It's been 9 years, and it'll be another 600. Such a drama queen. Dwayne isn't all that bad. I've had to fight so hard against him my whole life that he's helped serve as sort of a rocket away from the feeling that I'm worthless. He can be encouraging at times. He even lets me talk about him in public, because he knows he hurts me and feels bad about it sometimes. So you're sad. So you're not getting what you want. Why even try? You're not my enemy. You're my friend. We've been through this before, and we've made it out. All right. What do we do? What did we do last time? Well, we've got to get back into therapy. Maybe you and I do couples counseling. I say, going down the list of what I call my resiliency toolbox. Get back into Taekwondo, fewer fried foods, be vulnerable with the people we love.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Manage expectations, work on self-esteem, and we've got to be in constant communication. If you're not feeling good, I'm not feeling good. You've got to speak up sooner, and so do I. Deal? Fine. But less talky and more runny. Get your running shoes, Mr. I'm gonna take action. Hurry your ass up. Chill. I'm putting on my running gear as fast as I can. What should we listen to while jogging? Coldplay? You know me too well. Viva La Vida is my jam, yo. Let's roll, I say, as we take off into the streets of southern Los Angeles, the moon and the streetlights as our only guides. Joshua Rivadol is a speaker, actor, playwright, and stand-up comic, and the creator and founder of Changing Minds, a mental health-based curriculum, and the Impossible Project. He has spoken about suicide prevention and mental health across the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and Australia. www.iimpossibleproject.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Chapter United States Military Service by Alan Leggett.
When I share the fact that I served as an infantryman in the United States Army from 2004 to 2009, the most common response by far is, "Thank you for your service." In the 18 years since I first enlisted, I have yet to find a reply that feels genuine. "You're welcome" implies a small favor, like holding open a door, and does not capture the gravity of those 5 years. Embedded within the phrase, "Thank you for your service," are two preconceptions that I struggle with. One, that joining the military was a selfless act, and two, that my military service was benevolent. On September 11th, 2001, I was a 15-year-old sophomore in high school, living in the suburbs of New York City. My stepfather was a member of the National Guard and was activated to provide security to Ground Zero in the aftermath of the attacks. At a time when I might otherwise have started thinking about what college I might attend, what field I might major in, or what career I might pursue, it suddenly felt that the most important thing I could do with my life was to defend my country from further acts of terrorism. At least, that's what I told myself. There were many subconscious factors that influenced my decision to join the Army. Besides my stepfather, my biological father, my uncle, and both my grandfathers were also veterans. Military service in my family was so common, in fact, that I did not have any relatives who could explain to me the basic steps required to pursue higher education. And while I did have friends at school who were college-bound, it felt safer to risk my life in a war zone than to admit that I needed guidance. At the same time, I was struggling to accept that I was sexually attracted to both men and women. Despite the growing acceptance of the LGBTQ+ community, especially near a major city like New York, I did not feel safe exploring this part of my identity. Instead, I hoped that the military would serve as a form of conversion therapy, a proving ground where I could assert my straightness and masculinity. The 2003 invasion of Iraq did not dissuade me from joining the Army. At 18 years old, I accepted the premise that multiple, predominantly Muslim countries could work together to threaten the American way of life. It didn't matter to me at the time that these countries were more than 1,000 miles apart, nor that the United States had previously supported both the Taliban and Saddam Hussein's regimes in their respective wars against the Soviet Union and Iran. My military training was not overtly Islamophobic, but anti-Muslim sentiments were embedded in the culture regardless. Our drill sergeants regularly used racial slurs to describe Afghan and Iraqi civilians, and warned us that even men, women, and children could be employed as suicide bombers. We watched videos of Western journalists being beheaded by Al-Qaeda operatives set to the sound of Muslim prayers. During a cultural education training, a Christian chaplain gave us a multi-hour lecture on why Christianity was good and Islam was false, despite the fact that there were a handful of Muslim soldiers in the audience. By the time I deployed to Iraq in 2006, the term quagmire was widely used, both inside and outside the military. Saddam Hussein's regime had fallen, and we were in the process of nation-building against the tide of insurgency and civil war. Some days we met with local leaders to discuss developing public infrastructure. Other days we kicked down doors and arrested suspected terrorists, even when they were unarmed. At all times we had to be vigilant of the guerrilla tactics employed by the enemy: rockets, snipers, and roadside bombs, just to name a few. It did not take long before I grew to question the wisdom and morality of the war in Iraq, especially as I witnessed the egregious amounts of collateral damage we left in our wake. What kept me going was not my devotion to spreading democracy, but a concern for the safety of my fellow soldiers. When I separated from the military in 2009, I found a community of like-minded veterans called About Face, previously known as Iraq Veterans Against the War. In this community, I was able to take stock of the damage U.S. military intervention has done across the globe, to examine the racist, sexist, Islamophobic, and homophobic elements of the military culture, and to be critical of the tactics used to recruit socioeconomically disadvantaged youth into the military. The About Face community was especially valuable during the Trump presidency. I learned to leverage the social capital that comes with being a veteran to protest violence against marginalized communities. I don't hold it against people when they use the phrase, "thank you for your service," nor can I propose a better alternative. During the war on terror, the experiences of combat veterans have been largely siloed from the experiences of civilians, and it's natural for us to gravitate toward well-worn cultural scripts. I do, however, feel that we in the U.S. need to have uncomfortable conversations about whether the money and lives we spend on militarism are in fact making the world a better place.
Chapter Selling Sex by Carly Kalish. There are a million reasons someone might enter the sex trade, just like there are a million reasons someone might become a teacher, a chef, or a social worker. Can you think of another form of work where people make so many assumptions about how and why you got there? In this chapter, I hope to challenge two preconceptions. First, that everyone working in the sex trade has been coerced into that work. And second, that despite what we see in movies and other media, most sex trafficking is not foreign, but rather domestic and happening to young people and communities across the world. First, some terminology. My view is that sex work is a valid form of work, just like any other job, carrying it with it inherent risks and benefits. Sex trafficking, on the other hand, is about exploitation and coercion. It's a violation of fundamental human rights, and it is not a form of work at all. These two terms are very different, and it's dangerous to conflate sex work and sex trafficking. It may be helpful to think about the sex trade in terms of the three C's, which are on a spectrum. The three C's are choice, circumstance, and coercion. On one side of the spectrum is choice. Many sex workers are consenting adults choosing to engage in sexual acts in exchange for some form of payment. The sexual acts are consensual, and the person performing them gets to choose how the money they earn is spent. On the opposite side of the spectrum is coercion. In these situations, someone is being exploited, tricked, or forced to do sexual acts, and a person or group of people is benefiting from their exploitation. The final C, circumstance, which is in the middle of the spectrum, is where many people conflate sex trafficking and sex work. Circumstance is when a person's situation is inherently exploitive, but no person is directly exploiting them. Common examples of how circumstance can exploit include poverty, addiction, and mental illness. Someone performing sex work because of their social or economic circumstances is not the same as sex trafficking, and it is, in fact, dangerous to conflate the two. Many of the sex workers I've worked with over the past 10 years are sick of people wrongly assuming they're being exploited and need saving. Conversely, victims of sex trafficking by coercion are not getting the support they need because the media paints a completely inaccurate picture of what sex trafficking looks like. In fact, many survivors have told me that they didn't even know they were being trafficked because they understood trafficking to be completely different than their experience. Sex trafficking is usually a relational crime. It happens when someone builds a relationship with you for the purpose of ultimately forcing, tricking, or coercing you into the sex trade. It's often a boyfriend, friend, or even parent or caregiver who builds trust and then grooms you over time. The trafficker takes time to assess your vulnerabilities. They find out what needs are not being met in your life, and they offer to meet them. The trafficker starts by taking care of you and toys with your emotions until finally you rely on them and only them for support. Whatever it is that you feel is missing in your life, they position themselves as the solution to fill it. The second preconception about sex trafficking is that it is foreign victims being brought into another country. Data from support agencies, police, and government show the majority of sex trafficking that takes place in Canada and the United States, for example, is actually domestic trafficking. This may be an unsettling thought. For every high-profile story of a young girl brought into North America for the purposes of sex trafficking, there are dozens of other stories of young girls who are being exploited locally. Perhaps they started chatting with someone online, a guy in their neighborhood, or someone with whom they had mutual connections on social media. This new acquaintance might ask them about their hopes and dreams and really take time to get to know them on an intimate level. They then meet them in real life and fall in love. It isn't until a few months down the road that this new acquaintance might suggest that if only the young person can help them make some money, things could be even better. You know, all the things that I've done for you, those weren't free. You owe me. If you don't say yes, I'll post the nude that you sent me on social media. No one will have to know. It will be our secret. We'll keep the money we save for our future together. We can buy a car, rent an apartment of our own. Unfortunately, the number of such cases in North America is rising. Sex trafficking is one of the fastest growing crimes in Canada and the United States. Our response, however, should not be to ban sex work or to push it further underground where conditions of sex work by choice become more dangerous. Rather, the antidote is addressing the root causes of inequity and focusing on education and public health. Sex trafficking is a manifestation of inequity and is a human rights abuse. It thrives where there is a power imbalance. To stop human trafficking, we need to dismantle oppressive structures and understand gender-based violence. We must empower young people to make safe and healthy decisions and equip them with the tools to learn about consent and healthy relationships. Hopefully this chapter helps educate you, the reader, both about accepting those in the sex trade by choice and doing what is possible to prevent coercive situations.
And there you have it. Those are four of the entries in the book, Preconceived, Challenging the Preconceptions in Our Lives. I hope that you enjoyed them and listening to this episode. And I really hope you go to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, wherever you get your books on Amazon, and buy a copy of this book, Preconceived. Like I said, all profits from this book are going to the charity organization Pencils for Kids. And I think it's a really great read. And if you enjoy the podcast, I think it will be a really cool experience reading this book and hearing some of the insights that we've accumulated over the past few years on the show. Thank you, as always, for your continued support of the show. This show and this book wouldn't be possible without your continued support and listenership. Have a great day.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.